Shauna.
Jason.
Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. You have been working on sort of the same work for a very long time, but in different chapters, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Would that be a correct way to describe it, or?
I might not call it the same work.
I figured you'd say that. Okay, so what?
I hope that there is some variety within, let's call it a body of work.
You're working in the same body of work. Excuse me. Yes. Well, it's like.
But there are people who are obsessively working on the same. I could be making like a giant marble sculpture right now.
And doing the same thing over and over. What is that painting that woman worked on for years and years and years, and it weighed like 3 tons
like
or something?
Like it just got deep?
Yeah, it got really deep. Where is that? I can't even think of that. But yeah, anyway, you're not doing that. You're not working on an individual work. But it struck me when I was looking over all of your past exhibitions and everything. You've been working on a piece about the Surrealists and this fight that the Surrealists had back in the 1920s for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, when I started looking at this, how has that kept your interest over this period of time? Everything you do is very diverse. Mm-hmm. But how does that keep your interest?
Well, so maybe we should define a very long time. In this case, I think is about 4 years.
Well, I look back at 2012 or something. It's like,
yeah,
that's a long time to be considering something.
Yeah, but so let's say around 2011, I had finished sort of a body of work, how I sort of saw a body of work, a group of exhibitions using the same kind of research, maybe for a couple years. And it was a sort of body work about hysteria. And I kind of had this like natural, in a way, like a linear shift in my interest towards the Surrealists and the history of the Surrealists, which I can talk about. But I was really looking for something at that time, like to keep me in, like to keep my interest, literally. Yeah. I was like, what can hold my interest for more than 2 years? Because I don't want to go through this like artistic struggle of
anxiety,
like figuring out what the next thing is. Yeah. I might never want to do that again. This is how I felt in 2011. I was like, I think I don't want to do this anymore because I'm like in the lull between like my sort of obsessions and I didn't know where I was going.
Was it just stressful?
The anxiety.
Well, trying to figure out what the next thing is going to be. It is for me.
Yeah, and also I think it was like it was 2011, 12 would have been about 7 years out of grad school.
Right.
And I think it was also a moment where I was like, okay, am I really doing this? Well, what am I doing? I had a big like art crisis. And I kind of like started having friends over to my studio and just like trying to talk about what I was going through and what I might be interested in. And I kept coming back to this book over and over again, which was this autobiography of André Breton that I've been reading and like sort of obsessed with.
I took a photo of that and posted it on my Instagram like a while ago because you have all these little tabs on it.
Yeah.
Like hundreds of tabs on it. You've gone over this thing many, many times, I assume.
Yeah, and it was at that moment what I was interested in, but I still couldn't like see what was right in front of my face. And it was sort of through these conversations. I remember like very pointedly this like having Carrie Tribe over to my studio and me saying something like her being like, "Well, what are you interested in right now?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm really interested, like I keep reading this book over and over."
So how long had you had the book?
Not long. Like I had sort of fallen directly from the sort of previous body of work. I was looking at André Breton already, and the sort of Surrealist had made some direct comments.
So there was a correlation between the two things.
Yeah. And even in my show in 2010 at Suzanne Villemeter about this hysteria work called HYST et al., there was a sort of a small work. There was a drawing that was a reproduction of some of André Breton's notes. And that, so that was, so probably 2010 is when I started reading the book.
So that was a snap, and that pushed you into like finding the book and then moving from that into.
Yeah. And then what happened is like, I realized that like it, I, at first I started, I was like, oh, I'm interested in the, this like sort of specific thing, the history of the fistfights of the Surrealists. And that's how, that's what I call it. The history of the fistfights of the Surrealists. And there's a number of reasons why, and I can sort of outline them. But when I began working on that as my subject, I thought I was just making one show. And I knew there were 8 fistfights that I wanted to focus on between the years of 1923 and like 1937. They're all fights that have been covered in the newspapers.
So there were actually 8 separate fights
that I had on my list. And I wanted to make a show about this, these fistfights of the Surrealists.
Did they actually start as fights, or did they start as something and then turned into fistfights?
They all truly are art protests.
Every single one of them.
They were art protests that devolve or evolve into like a physical altercation. So they're all fights about art and the meaning of art, and specifically surrealism, the meaning of surrealism and the use of surrealism and its circulation, like in the art world, in the like literary, in the sort of broader cultural world at that time.
Wasn't the idea of maybe one of those first ones? And what I had thought I'd seen was that it was this idea that a few of the artists is sold out that were in that group or that body of artists. So the fistfight started out of a protest of sort of selling out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's basically in these 8 fights, each one can be pointed to an artist acting in a way that was not like purely in the surrealist way as outlined by André Breton. And he was a real like bureaucrat, and there were kind of like guidelines almost that you would have to follow, and he could challenge you and say like.
So he was the founder or leader of this sort of movement.
Yeah. Right. And it's kind of, it's gatekeeper.
That's really intense.
It's intense. And, it, you know, and I feel like we're kind of coming at it in this funny way right now, but it's, yeah, it's very intense.
Yeah, me calling you out and making a piece over. Why are you making quick work? This makes no sense.
But it, you know, so, but what, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that I had laid out this structure, and I was like, there's the history of the fistfights. Here's this brief descriptions of them. And now I'm going to make all these sculptures that I sort of, that grew out of my encounters with this history and my encounters in, through the experience of research in Paris and in at the Getty and all these places. And I was just, so I was like, I'm just going to make a group of sculptures that are kind of guided by my research in this topic. And as I started putting together the show, I realized like, oh, wait, this is 8 shows. Each one, each fistfight is a show. And each one is a chapter. And each one sort of requires its own research to tell the story. And that's sort of where I am now. I'm like in still working on chapter 4, and I'm like 4 years in. So this might be an 8-year project.
Which is great.
I mean, it's great for me because I don't have that anxiety breakdown in between shows anymore where I don't know what I'm going to do.
It is great for me as a viewer too, because really the reason I asked the question in the very beginning was because you're, the body of work is so diverse, and the objects that you make along with the wall pieces that you make are, but the performances too alone are just so sort of intense and amazing. I wanted to go more into talking to you about what the performances sort of entail, but I wanted to get back to, you spoke a lot about the research.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another thing, and I've seen you do this knowing you for a little while now. The amount of research that you do is sort of breathtaking for me, because I think that I sort of get in depth with the things that I'm doing, but you were in DC for quite a while here recently,
mm-hmm.
for your show, where it was the Hirshhorn,
mm-hmm.
Which is an amazing institution. So like, I was so jealous to hear that you had the show coming up, but you took full advantage of that opportunity and were researching the entire time. Can you talk a bit about mm-hmm. that?
Yeah. Well, I also, sort of in parallel to having the show at the Hirshhorn, had this a sort of research fellowship at the Smithsonian, like the Smithsonian Artists Research Fellowship.
How did those line up together? Did you seek it out?
Yeah. And basically, I mean, it made sense. So, I mean, the curator that I was working with at the Hirshhorn, Miki Yoshitake, was like, oh, well, I want to propose doing this show. And I also think that
this could work along with. It would make sense
for you to apply for the SARF program. So they were two, you know, by no means a coincidence, but they're in a theory, one could have fallen through and the other would have still happened or vice versa, you know.
Which is great for an artist.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, to kind of go into, you know, the role of research in my work, I think that it's in some way what grounds me. I'm not grounded in a medium. Like, I'm not grounded, like, in terms of a practice, I have a very hard time staying focused in one sort of, like, physical material.
I say a majority of your time is spent with the research and, like, discovering these things and sort of adapting to figuring out how you're going to use it to create these objects or create sort of the movements that you do.
Yeah, and I also think of it as, like, the grounding in terms of setting a tone, like, filling my mind with this sort of objects, images, stories of this time, of this history, then infiltrates everything that I see and make in a way. So it's like I'm going into this other world and it letting it influence me in all these different ways. And it comes out in writing. And I've sort of organized it so there's like a piece of writing for each fistfight or chapter. Each one's a chapter. So there's a piece of writing, there's a set of sculptures, and there's a performance or like a live, real-time element. And so because you can't kind of collapse those things into each other, like they're all different ways of communicating. And they're, you know, a sculpture can't tell a like deeply intricate like social
note. You need all the parts to form the whole.
Yeah. And also that they don't actually form a whole. Like something else that's really important to me is maintaining all the different versions. Like
in what way?
Allowing there to be different perspectives on this story at once.
So and, it can be read multiple ways?
Yeah. And not one of them being the true absolute correct or whole.
Or
yeah. So even when I write, I'm always kind of like constantly acknowledging and pointing to the fact that I'm an artist pursuing my own interests and my interests are like the sort of like discovery of history and the kind of freeing up of the idea of like an objective truth in terms of history by revealing all of these multiple perspectives at once and kind of like showcasing how they are not collapsible into one narrative as an art historian is required to tell like one narrative.
Are you challenging history in any way? Like, are you challenging the sort of like a singular story?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I am. And, but I'm not necessarily challenging it by offering a correction.
A corrected version.
I'm, like pointing at things. Like, I feel like that's the one of the great like liberties of being an artist. Like, what's the role of an artist in society today? And like, I always come back to this, like, and this is way too simple, but it's like, you can experiment and try things out without consequences of the quote unquote real world. So like, if I'm an artist who's taking on wearing a hat of like a researcher or an academic art historian type person, I don't have the same requirements to deliver a dissertation that fits into that discipline. In the same way, when you are an artist making something that resembles a piece of furniture, like it doesn't have to stand up to the same tests that a piece of furniture would. Or when Jorge Pardo makes a lamp, or when, I don't know. I mean, I could go on.
I totally understand.
There's like a freedom there that allows us to question authority really and like to open things up to interpretation.
So was your choice of picking the fistfights this sort of challenge against sort of the status quo of like what or not necessarily status quo. Was it this thing was a challenge or was sort of a front to a way or a particular way of thinking, but like what you're doing essentially with your work is also challenging a particular way of thinking about the history of like how we look at objects and art in general.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And like the, for me, the beautiful thing about like a fist fight as an example of a quote unquote historical moment to unpack is that it's at the same moment, it's like a dramatic, like beautiful, true physical expression. It's also like a pathetic, like macho breakdown in an argument. You know, these are poets and like,
and who devolve into something that is like the most base of, yeah, of ways of arguing.
Yeah,
instead of using their intellect.
Yeah, they go to the hospital with a broken nose.
It's just a bunch of dudes in a room.
Yeah. And so that's, and then like that other layer is like, you know, I'm a woman reconsidering.
Well, this was one of my questions, right? Yeah. So for as a woman looking at a bunch of guys fighting in a room and picking this sort of the most base of ways of having an argument, like that was a consideration.
Yeah, most definitely. That it were these moments where women were physically excluded, but in a way by choice, because what woman wants to be in, you know, it just doesn't, the fist fight.
Have you found that through your research then too, about some of the women that were party to this movement at the time that weren't necessarily involved in sort of the confrontation, not necessarily the fighting, but like the talks,
like aggressive acts. Yeah. I mean, in each of these protests, as let's say, I can't think of any examples in the newspaper reports that I've read about these fights that broke out where there was a woman involved as a kind of aggravator,
antagonist, or
yeah. Yeah, it was always, and it's often was like a, there were a few, like Robert Desnos was a real hothead. You know, Andre Breton would sort of push things in motion, but not really be in the mix totally.
Do you think that is also, though, a, could that be a factor of the fact that women were sort of excluded from the conversation in the writing as well, the history as well, too?
Yeah.
Just not written about, period. So if there was a woman who was actually sort of, she just would have been excluded regardless.
Yeah, I mean, maybe excluded from the telling of the fist fight because no one would say, oh, Valentin Hugo punched, you know, Yvonne Goll in the face.
Well, I guess
that just wouldn't be in the newspaper.
Well, my question would be more toward the relationship between less about the actual confrontation, physical mm-hmm. confrontation, but the participating in the movement.
Yeah, no, and that's, I think, that is at least something that has been taken up by like contemporary historians, a kind of like revisionist art history to make sure that the like women who were present in the movement are recognized and accounted for. And, you know, you can find a book of the role of the Surrealist women artists like within the movement, but they were pushed to the sidelines. Yeah. Some of them were, I mean, you know, Andre Breton was married 3 times. All of these women were very important to him artistically, intellectually. They were like very intelligent. 2 of them were like okay artists on their own right, you know.
Well, at least you're honest.
But, you know, but I do, you know, I think that He was sexist and he was homophobic, and that plays out in who was a kind of the Surrealist. You know, the other thing is like the Surrealists as a movement was primarily populated by writers. The artists that they looked to and followed and that Breton really championed weren't necessarily like 100% quote unquote Surrealist, but they had like Surrealist tendencies, like Picasso, de Chirico. They weren't part of like his movement, let's say, because Picasso was, you know, he's
right.
Picasso's Picasso. He's always doing his own thing, but he was friends with him and in this, in like
he's friends.
Their circles
the first,
overlap.
It seems like that maybe was the first part of being in the circle to begin with,
mm-hmm.
was being friends with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, much like today.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, you know, another layer of this research is to look at this network of people and how they circulated and helped each other and hurt each other and how it's not all that different. I mean, what I find when I'm doing historical research, the thing that another thing that keeps me going is like this pretty frequent feeling where I'm like, wow, people are so much more the same, like
than different. They're the exact same that they are now.
Yeah. And like the technology that we're surrounded with maybe has changed a little bit.
But the people
have not. This like human drive and like insecurity and the kind of like positive and negative forces that were driven by.
Artists are some of the most insecure people in the world. We need constant validation.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of like the narcissism like that is present in the art world. But yeah, I do think that I find like, yeah, and I look for connections as much as I'm looking for differences.
So when you're thinking about the aspect of theater in your work, mm-hmm. and the performances, you were in Performa 13,
mm-hmm.
right? So one of the chapters was portrayed at Performa 13.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do a performance? You were in the Whitney Biennial.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do a performance piece in that as well, too? Is there always a performance piece with each one of the aspects of the work?
In theory, yes. At the Whitney, I didn't do a performance. The Whitney was just a kind of collection of sculptures.
Installation.
Yeah. Yeah. And Performa, for example, was just the play that went with chapter one. So where the exhibition, which was called The Bearded Gas, was first, it was 2013, I guess, was at Zenville Meadow here. And then it also traveled and was shown in Cleveland at the Museum of Art in Cleveland at this Transformer Station space that they had there.
It's a fantastic space.
Yeah. And yeah, that was great. That was the first show there. It was a group show called The Unicorn, and it was like four artists, and it was really great.
I was actually just over there talking to a curator and they mentioned you in that show.
Oh, nice. It
left a mark.
It was a really good show, I think. But so then the performance for that chapter one was the Performa 13 like play. And so it's my intention that each of these pieces exists separately, but they can all be together. But you can't read an essay and watch a play and look at an installation all at the same time.
It's too much.
Yeah.
Because you're going to lose information out of one of them while you're doing
it. Yeah. And it's not designed in my mind to be like that. It's like you could read this essay. You could read it while you're sitting next to the sculptures.
Do they
inform? And it might change the way
you... Do they inform the sculpture?
Not directly. Like, right. I don't think sculpture should be pedantic.
No, yeah, absolutely not.
Like, so the sculptures are kind of like, I like to think of them as they've been infected by the history, or they're like dream
objects. That's a nice way to
objects.
Look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, like dream objects. They might have been there, and then they were like forever morphed into these like uncanny, weird beings.
When we first met, I didn't. Like, I only knew you as a sculptor. I didn't know you did performance and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know your background at all. So I was like, oh, she's really a good sculptor. And then I looked, somebody said, oh, she does performance. And I was like, oh, I wonder if she's a dancer or something. I had no idea. I felt so naive. Because then when I started looking at your work like a long time ago, the theater of that is mm-hmm. really intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of theater for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like back in college.
Really?
Yeah. But... I got the hell out, but the theater of this whole thing and like the way you set this up, I want to ask you how you portray those characters in, do you call them plays? Do you call them acts? What do you call them?
Sometimes I call it a play, but that does feel a little hokey.
Well, I mean, yeah, I know. But do you write a script?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple questions, yeah. So I'll ask them first.
Yeah.
Do you write a script? Do you actively direct your actors when you're putting this together, like rehearsals, like how often mm-hmm. are you rehearsing? And are you in these as well, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right as of now, I've made the installations for four chapters and I've done two plays. So I've done the play for chapter one and chapter three. And like right now, as of tomorrow, I'm starting to work on the play for chapter four, which will
really
premiere. I'm supposed to kind of start work kind of tomorrow. Yeah. I gotta figure it out by tomorrow.
You just said it. Now you have to do it.
That's part of why I'm saying it. But so that will, the chapter four play will premiere in LA in September.
Where?
The exact venue is to be determined.
Is it through your
it's
gallery?
It's through LAX Art. It's a commission for the, as part of the LAX Art Occasional.
And so, you had worked with LAX Art previously as well, too.
Yes, although I've never done a show.
Like a proper show.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had a long relationship from the beginning. I've sort of been an artist and helped out and designed cards for a while. And I've been a part of that organization.
I'm going to get into this later, but like you are very active across all spectrums of sort of Los Angeles art scene, but like by choice. And it's, we'll talk about it in a bit, but the show.
Okay. So performance, let me answer this question. So, and so the performances or plays, first of all, necessarily are dictated by the sort of story of the fight that they're looking at. And so in the case of chapter one and chapter three, I would say they're both plays with actors, both plays with actors that I like directed a lot. And now I think through that experience, I'm a good director and I love working with actors.
Had you done this before or not?
A little bit. I had a little bit.
Like school or what?
I had a piece that I've done like five or six times that I first did in 2006 called Hear It Here.
Oh, wow.
That involves these two actors and it's a set, it's a structure. It was a structure, it was the first time was at Art Basel Miami in 2006 when like Jens Hoffman was curating this art perform thing that still happens, art perform still happens. And so it's a structure where there's like two actors. This is a digression, but I'll just go
through it. It is, but I'm interested. I'm totally interested.
there's two actors on a stage, and they're both wearing headphones, as you and I are both wearing headphones now, and they're standing in front of microphones. And in the audience, the space of the audience is placed two microphones that kind of are mirroring the actors' positions on the stage. And from the very beginning, there's a voiceover, which is usually me, and I say, you know, welcome to this performance of Hear It Here. The performance will last 50 minutes. Every 10 minutes, an accordion will play a song for 1 to 2 minutes. And you, the audience, are invited to speak into the microphones in front of you, and the actors will repeat what they hear without interpretation. And so the performance audience is up to you. And then the actors would just stand there
and wait.
And the audience members would speak in. And what would happen is you would just repeat what the actors would repeat what they heard without interpretation. They weren't acting it out.
Not a whole lot of direction. By the way, that piece sounds amazing.
It's pretty amazing. And it's been repeated, you know. So first time in Miami, that was kind of the most awkward. I learned a lot. then it was part of the California Biennial in 2008, and which happened both in Orange County and in Santa Barbara. I did it at the what is now the MCA Santa Barbara, but it had a different name, which I'm forgetting at the moment. And then I also did it at SOMA in Mexico City and in Zurich. And there's one other. Oh, and in New York, in Performa 09, I did it as part of this kind of curated, a sort of slightly like offshoot section that I think.
Does it get
Elizabeth
better each
D
time?
Yeah, it gets better each time.
Why? What do you do that's different that makes it better each time? Because you're not actively, are you changing?
No, and the script that I just repeated from memory is basically always the cue.
You're not changing the parameters of what's happening. So why does it change?
I don't know. I think because I understand the crowd. I don't know.
Maybe. But you're not actively doing anything during that to...
I mean, maybe it's just, it's almost coincidence that the Performa 09 crowd at the DIA, like at that, the bookstore space on 22nd Street, uh-huh. when it was empty, remember when it was empty for a while? Yeah. So it was in the first floor space on a Friday night.
So it was busy.
It was maybe just the ideal audience.
Yeah, it was perfect.
It was the perfect audience for it. And so maybe now I know I won't now do it with where, a crappy audience.
You totally
anymore.
Know where it should be shown because you know the piece. You've seen it so
yeah,
many times.
Yeah. So.
Well, but I mean, just to mm-hmm. finish that for me, like an artist knowing their audience and making mm-hmm. a work or adjusting the work to sort of fit. You didn't change the work. You changed the location.
Yeah. Well, and.
Sort of by chance. But like also that's just it's smart after a certain amount of time doing those things.
Well, and I also think that. What that piece sort of highlighted for me in relationship to sculpture and making installations. And I almost would say I more like cite sculptures in relation to each other as opposed to making an installation, right? I like to think that I'm making like discrete objects that are together, but the last few years I've been putting them on platforms together. And so they're somewhere in between a kind of,
it strikes me that like, knowing you, you could get a thing in a space and totally change it around at the last moment and have it work home a whole lot better than sort of a preconceived idea, but you're willing to do that when you get into space too.
Yeah, sometimes you have to, it's, yeah, I mean, site responsive or something, right? That's not necessarily well, site specific.
A lot of artists are not flexible like that. Mm-hmm. So it's an important thing to like learn as an artist to be flexible and allow these adjustments to take place in process.
And I think maybe in part for me, it's because I'm trying to create a certain feeling or like a space where a viewer can have certain emotional feelings or reactions to objects or ideas or things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the conditions for making someone feel something, it's like a real specific thing.
Completely different.
Yeah, it's like a really, you know, it's like a, yeah, it's like a feeling that. You got to work to like make that set it right, like the lighting or just how somebody enters a room and what they see first. And
that's amazing. I'm totally.
That.
I'm so glad we got off track.
Thank
I
you.
Really am. That's fantastic.
Well, should I go back to the questions?
Yes. I'm okay. Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Okay. So, for the performances, I do work with actors, which I admitted I love, and but I do write a script, but it's almost like in the two that I've completed so far and the one I'm about to start working on, I think of them more as like a collage. So what I'm trying to do with the performances is present material that's like crucial to these fistfights, these moments, these that present the like artworks that like the quote unquote primary artworks of these events. In other words, like for the first fist fight, it happened at this multimedia like program that Tristan Zara curated one night where all these writers were speaking, Eric Satie and like Stravinsky were like piano music was being played, Man Ray's first film premiered, and then Sonia Delaunay made the costumes and sets for this play, The Gas Heart of Tristan Zara's. That was supposed to be the final act. So all of these freaking amazing artworks were also like present at the first fistfight of the Surrealists. You know, like Charles Sheeler and Paul Strand's Manhattan, which is this beautiful film, this Hans Richter film, Rhythmus 21. They were all shown as part of this night.
It was like a perfect storm.
Yeah. And so what I wanted to show this like to the audience while telling the story of what happened as a way of like getting to that feeling of like what was it like to be there just for a second, or what, how do we imagine it was like to be there now? And so for the first play, it took form as like a narrator giving a lecture, as if I was giving a lecture, but he, and it was.
Were you the narrator?
I cast someone as a narrator who who's an artist, Joey Frank, who's kind of amazing. He lives in Brooklyn. So Joey Frank was my narrator, but he's also a very good friend who, like, I knew he could hang out with all the time for a couple months.
You knew
while
he didn't
we
body
rehearsing.
What you needed to do, but also, like,
he brought a lot to it.
Yeah, right.
He brought his own character, and that I think that's something that I was interested in too. Like, what's collaboration? Like, you know, and I would say that, and this again kind of mirrors these surrealist performances where they were sort of all working together and collaborating with each other, in or like helping each other realize their work. And so, so Joey was the narrator, and his lecture kept getting interrupted by these like actors who had these sets and costumes who were basically contributing quotes from Zara's play.
They were portraying actors? Actors portraying actors, or were they portraying other people?
They were like being actory. But yeah, they were they spoke only in quotations essentially from these artworks.
Gotcha.
Or from critics of the time who were like talking about the fight or about what was going on between this sort of battle between the end of Dada and the kind of establishing of surrealism. So, and you know, and then there was like live piano. We screened the films, borrowed them from MoMA, showed them on 16mm.
Oh, wow.
Like, so it was a multimedia performance.
Very
that mirrored, and... yeah, it mirrored the original like July 6, 1923
sounds
multimedia
lovely.
Performance.
How long was it?
It's like 55 minutes.
Oh, so
I like to keep stuff
the,
short.
Yeah, because otherwise nobody can sit through this. Though.
Yeah.
People, or they're forced.
Yeah. I like to keep it short. And then the chapter 3 play, which did premiere at the same time as the like installation, sculptures, and essay at the Prez Art Museum in Miami. That play, again, was I worked with two actors to learn these scenes from this play that Louis Aragon had written in 1924 that were part of that were performed on the night that this fist fight happened. And so we learned these scenes, and it was almost like straight, like just these three scenes, but they were kind of interrupted by this piano playing music from the time and this film by Germaine Dulac called The Seashell and the Clergyman that ties into the story. And then there was like some kind of context given by a voiceover that was reading these newspaper descriptions of the fight. So in other words, I didn't technically write anything for that one. It was just a collage of like newspaper reports being read, the scenes from the play.
But there was a lot of direction.
But I
tons of
really
direction.
Directed it. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So yeah. I think that answers your
question. You did go through all three
questions.
Thank you. Finally, it took you so long.
I know.
Okay, going back into then, I said I'd come back to it. Like in LA, I feel like you're very present. Part of that is that you help run Extra mm-hmm. magazine, quarterly art magazine, that I didn't know about until I moved to LA, and I feel very... I think it's unfortunate that I did not, because it offers a lot of insight to what's happening here, but there's some amazing articles and everything. Can you talk a little bit about what Extra is? It's been around since 1997.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so
you didn't start it.
I did not start Extra.
Right.
I kind of came to Extra. I came to LA to go to grad school at UCLA.
Out of where?
I was living.
You were born in New York, right?
Yeah, I was born in New York.
Long Island?
I grew up in Long Island. Then I was, you know, went to college, came back, was living in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint, working at a gallery in Chelsea. And
did you ever get out of the city? Like, where'd you go to college?
I went to college in Providence. I went to Brown.
Okay.
And
so a little bit out of the city, but like,
yeah,
you're still on the East Coast.
Yeah, but I still spent the summers in the New York. I still like went back like once a month on the weekends. You know, so then, yeah, I was living in Brooklyn, working in Chelsea, and just sort of had this feeling like, I got to get out of here because I'm going to be here forever. I'm always going to live in New York.
That's sort of like the New York thing though, right? It traps you.
Yeah. So I should leave for a while and come back. So I was like, I want to go to grad school, and I want to go to grad school in Chicago or LA, because those were like places where like art schools with like heart and soul.
No,
were.
Absolutely. Well, those are the two other cities that everybody perceives as being the next thing outside of New York.
Yeah. And especially, you know, this was 2001 and LA had just kind of been getting a lot of press. There's that like famous Spin article about the like grad school at UCLA.
So you're like, I'm going to follow Spin's advice.
No. That was, I think my applications were already in when that was. Okay. Anyway, but the point is that I escaped New York and I went to Chicago where I could work part-time and do my grad school applications, work in my studio.
Oh, wait,
more.
So you went to Chicago?
I moved to Chicago.
I thought this whole story was going to you moving to LA.
Well, there's a little... There's 6 months, 9 months in Chicago in between that are very important to my story of Extra.
I'll let you finish. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Because the reason they're important to my story of Extra is because the reason I was able to move to Chicago is that I wrote to this small, or not that small, but a nonprofit art magazine there, which you might know, called New Art Examiner, that was in Chicago at that point. They were like 29 years old in Chicago.
Had you been reading it in New York? You knew about it or what?
I knew about it. I worked at a gallery in New York as the archivist, you know, so I knew.
So you saw all this stuff.
Yeah. And I also, when I was in college, I ran a magazine. I just kind of liked it, you know, so I wrote to them, asked if they needed any help and they said yes. And I said, okay, this is my way out. So I took this job as like a part-time production coordinator.
Smart. It's good.
And I loved it. And, but while I was there, the magazine went under.
Oh.
Like, things were dark. It was...
That's why they needed help.
It's like complicated. And this is not the time to get into it. But so then I got into UCLA and I decided, you know, the magazine was shutting down. And so, and I was moving to LA. So moved to LA and I thought, you know, I really liked having this connection to this art journal.
Right. Yeah.
And so I wrote to Extra and said, hi, to LA. It was around Warner, the grad studios.
Got you.
And I saw it and I thought it looked great. It was back when it was still like totally newsprint and like one color.
They looked like little newspapers.
Yeah, they were. But I mean, they were staple bound, you know, kind of almost 8.5 by 11. But I mean, they looked great. At that time, I think Connie Pertill was doing the design that year. And I said, do you need any help? I just moved here. And they said, yeah, actually, can you tell us what happened at New Art Examiner? Because we want to make sure we don't make those same mistakes.
I'm like, by the way, that's genius of them to even ask.
They're very smart people.
That's really smart.
And so that's how I sort of started with Extra. And then we had this kind of this meeting and it was kind of through that meeting that I realized how much I had learned through that experience about how to run a nonprofit and how not to, and about the magazine world and about funding it. And all I learned so much in my year there.
For them to even, I mean, that just shows that like ego wasn't taking place where they were going to ask somebody, give us the information. We're going to learn from that. So we can, and then it taught you something too, to trust your sort of self and your instincts.
Yeah, it was. And then, so then I said, well, do you guys need any help? And they did. They needed somebody to check the mail once a week and like answer and like, you know, send the magazines out 4 times a year. And so I started then while I was still in grad school. My job was office and it was probably like 6 hours a week.
Right. But that's good for you in grad school anyway.
Yeah. I
did. Perfect.
I mean.
Anything more would have been too much.
I was also like TAing 4 classes and like working somewhere. I mean, I had.
And
like,
making artwork.
Yeah. So I didn't need anything to. So, and then I kind of just like stuck with it. And so Extra was founded in the 90s by a group of artists who are still involved. Like the primary.
Is there a board of directors?
Yeah, so it's a nonprofit now. I'm now the executive director of the nonprofit that publishes Extra called Project X Foundation for Art and Criticism. And the journal itself has an editorial board of like 10 people, of which I'm also a part. But
how long have you been in the position you're in now with Extra?
As executive director?
Yeah.
I sort of established that position 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago. And we never had an executive director before that. And before that, I was the managing editor, which Extra had also never had a managing editor before.
So you're sort of growing it and it's adapting with time.
Yeah. And as, we're all kind of, it's not exactly professionalizing, but it's growing and the budget grows, but with such kind of care and like conservative in a kind of really good growth, like of a not small arts nonprofit way. I mean, but I would say in the 12 years now that I've been involved with Extra, 13 maybe,
wow.
You know, the budget has doubled or something, but that's going from like $0 to $2. And so everything is very kind of like considered, and the beauty of it is that it also folds in perfectly to my studio practice and the way I need to travel for my work. Somehow it all just kind of goes together.
I do the same with my work, my day job, where I'm able to like travel and it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I could not, even teaching is much more of a constraint in terms of planning exhibitions.
Locked in every Friday or whatever for a certain amount of time.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's obviously that's bearable. And I would be making more money and have health insurance if I were teaching full time. But I think there's a lot of other things that would like be would bring me down. I mean, I'm really appreciative for being a part of this sort of Extra community and what we've been able to do. There's a lot more that I wish we were able to do better, but we're always working on it.
I'm thinking about the role of you sort of diversifying the practice and doing all these things at once and then doing Extra at the same time. It seems to me like you need to be active and having your hands in a lot of different things at once mm-hmm. in order to be productive.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think that by diversifying my portfolio, I'm less likely to be like bored or maybe from the outside pegged down as like stuck in one thing or another.
That seems like a real concern for you. Mentally, to be free to allow yourself to expand beyond like the boundaries or the structures that you've put up or like mm-hmm. somebody else is going to impose on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day that like, I don't know what my problem is, but for some reason, it's very important to me to be competent at everything, you know, like I think that's important.
Well, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
I get that.
But instead of, I could just focus on being really good at one thing. I don't want, because then like this sort of, maybe it's that the possibility of failure becomes larger. Like if you put all your eggs in one basket, then, but I mean, this doesn't logically map onto like, why would somebody like myself work in a wide variety of mediums? It's not because like if I only made things with lead, then you know, all my eggs would be in one basket or something. But it almost is like that. It's like I don't believe in like a singular idea being the best one. Like I'm always like weighing all the options for everything, and I feel like it's necessary for me to explore all options.
So the idea that you're doing these things all at once is not a bad thing to me. I feel the same way. I want to be able to sort of hit as many things as I can at once, and not necessarily to, I think it's great to focus. Like I stopped painting for like 6 years and I didn't do anything other than sculpture because I knew I needed to get really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You're currently able to do that without having to focus in on those certain things.
It's become harder for me lately to try to do more than one thing at a time. And so I find myself, and I don't necessarily think this is bad, like compartmentalizing where I know for the next 3 weeks, I'm going to focus on making this sculpture. And I'm not even going to try to read or write or anything. I'm just, all my energy is going to be making this piece. And then as soon as that's done, I know that I need to write this essay and I'm going to spend these 3 days doing that and nothing else. Because
how's that working for you?
It works. It's the only way I can get things done. So it's like I can do, you know, otherwise, if I don't talk myself into this kind of like focus schedule, I'm just answering emails all day. You know what I mean? Like either, right. like I have to, because I could, I know I could be working on that sculpture and I know I could be writing. So I better just answer these emails right now or yeah. something, you know? And so, but it's good because it means I can have this kind of serious sculptor moment and figure something out. And then, but then I have to go over here and figure out how to write about this thing, you know? Yeah.
I've known you for a while now. This has been really enlightening to speak to you about the work. You told me things I had no idea.
Well, thanks. It's really, I feel like you're going to be really good at this.
Thanks. Well, it sheds a whole new light on you and like what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.